Welcome to today's podcast from Nature 2030, an international campaign to build a formidable coalition to rise to the challenge of the global climate crisis. These podcasts are part of our quest to bring together influential activists, politicians, business and thought leaders to focus on solutions to the climate crisis. Today, joining our discussion is Will McCallum, Head of Oceans for Greenpeace UK. Will has been at the forefront of ocean protection and anti-plastic movements since he first began at Greenpeace back in 2007. During this time, he has fronted some impressive campaigns relating to fishing policies, ocean plastic, deposit return schemes, marine reserves, and much more. He's currently leading a campaign to establish an Antarctic Ocean Sanctuary. Between all of this, he has also found time to write a book titled How to Give Up Plastic, which was published last year. Go out and buy it. Will, thank you so much for joining us. Can you start by telling us a little more about your background and what it was that first ignited your interest in environmentalism?
Well, I had a very outdoorsy upbringing with a lot of time spent out in nature. You know, I was lucky enough to have grandparents who lived in the countryside and would regularly take us out and explain what was, you know, what we were looking at. But there wasn't a sort of moment of choosing I wanted to be an environmentalist at all. It was very much a slow understanding of the science and the politics of climate change that brought me in over a period of time, sort of reading about what was going on and what we were doing to the planet in terms of carbon emissions, essentially got me worried. And I got worried, and instead of sort of burying my head in the sand, I wanted to get active and join protests, joined groups, and eventually found myself working for an environmental NGO.
Great. And so how have you seen environmentalism change in the last few years?
It's a lot more mainstream now, and I think there's a lot more public awareness of the need for quite urgent radical action, and we see people calling for far more wide sweeping changes to society than I think we thought was possible even just 4 or 5 years ago, let alone 10, 15 years ago. But I say that with a small caveat, which is that in the run-up to the Copenhagen climate talks, which was in 2009, and you know, anyone that was around in the environmental movement then knows how much anticipation there was ahead of those climate talks, expecting Obama to come in and really sort it all out. And we had very widespread awareness of the environmental issues back then, and yet it all sort of faded away in the years following that failure at Copenhagen to come to an ambitious agreement. So that being mainstream and being part of the cultural norm, it isn't something that we should take for granted at all.
Tell us a bit about your role at Greenpeace.
So I'm the head of oceans for Greenpeace UK, which means I oversee any campaign that we do that relates to marine issues, be that pollution, fishing, marine reserves, whatever's out there going on is kind of fair game for us to campaign on. And, you know, our campaigns are very much geared towards the same thing. We try and get businesses, we try and get politicians to make decisions and to change laws, change policies in favor of the planet. And, you know, it's a lot of fun being at Greenpeace. Is you have a very wide selection of tools you can use with your campaigning, everything from going out onto ships to do scientific research to scaling a building and hanging a banner. So my role involves doing a bit of all of those things, but mainly managing a team that do all of those things.
What's been the most powerful campaign that you've worked on at Greenpeace?
I think the most powerful campaign that I've worked on has to be the plastics campaign, because that was the first time I had ever worked, and this includes before I worked on environmental issues, when I worked on education and then military issues. This was the first time I worked on a campaign that people didn't need any persuading to care about it. They just were already there. And I remember we commissioned some polling before we started that campaign, that sort of just to gauge where the public interest was. And what we found in that polling was, yes, people saw climate change as the most important environmental issue, but the one they cared most about was plastic pollution. This was before Blue Planet. It was before Greenpeace's plastics campaign. It was before any of the sort of mainstream plastic stuff that happened on later. It was, you know, 2014, 2015, people already really cared about it. They'd seen plastic on the beach. They'd seen it in the park. They'd seen a YouTube video of a straw being pulled out of a turtle's nose, and they cared about it. And being able to start a campaign from that point, so you're not having to do any education or awareness raising, people are already emotionally invested is just a gift. You know, you could just hit the ground running with, you know, straight in there with, what are the solutions? What are we going to do about it? We have to do something now, and everybody's saying so. So it was great.
And what was great.
It's still going on.
What's been the biggest win so far in that campaign?
There have been a few big wins. I think, well, the announcement that we'll have a deposit return scheme was certainly one of the first ones. It hasn't come into place yet, but we're hoping for it. The microbeads ban was the first win, I think, of the plastics campaign, really. But there have been some other ones that have kind of snuck through. So things like Tesco coming straight out and saying no more recyclable plastic by the end of 2019. You know, they did that quite early on. Iceland saying no more single-use plastic by 2023. Sainsbury's saying 50% reduction by 2025. So actually you're starting to build that groundswell of big influential corporate players saying, we don't just need to improve recyclability. We don't just need to reduce the weight of the plastic packaging. We actually need to reduce the overall volume that is going onto our shelves. And that change in the what's considered good when it comes to plastics policy is a major win.
We've obviously had the plastic bag charges around the world as well.
Exactly.
Another good one. Tell us a bit about the Antarctic Sanctuary campaign. Why do we need to protect the Antarctic? Surely no one's going down there and fishing, are they?
You'd be surprised. So our Antarctic campaign is part of a global vision that would see 30% of the world's oceans protected by 2030. And the way you pick that 30% is by really looking at, well, we need to cover every base. You know, we need to make our oceans more resilient to threats like climate change. We need to protect the coral reefs as well as the Antarctic, as well as the Arctic, as well as, you know, the Sayadamala Bank in the Indian Ocean, seagrass meadows. You know, there are so many amazing habitats. And the Antarctic is one where the UK has got a very specific history there. It's very invested in the environment, but it's also right now, you know, it's in a unique place of being both one of the most pristine wildernesses you've ever seen. And I'm lucky enough to have gone there twice on our ships. And I have never seen wilderness of the kind that you see in the Antarctic. It is untouched, spectacular reminder of what the planet could look like if humans managed to protect nature properly. And yet it is also one of the most vulnerable places in the world, because as an ice-covered continent, it is facing climate change like only the other polar region is. So it's warming at almost four times the rate of anywhere else on the planet. We're seeing new species showing up there. We're seeing ocean currents changing before our eyes. And the very chemistry of the ocean is being altered by the amount of carbon that it's soaking up. So the polar regions, Arctic and Antarctic, they're experiencing those changes far, far quicker than anywhere else on the planet. And so you have this pristine wilderness that's also changing at an incredibly fast rate. And protecting it, so putting large areas of it off limits to human activities like fishing, like it's already off limits to mining, but only until the 2040s when the Antarctic Treaty gets renegotiated. By putting them off limits, you make it more resilient. You allow the wildlife there to grow in number and to grow in diversity. And that means, you know, if there's a particularly warm year, if there's a particularly extreme weather event, it has a much better chance of survival.
Mm. What do you think is the single biggest threat to our oceans right now?
I think long term, the single biggest threat to every habitat, oceans and forests and absolutely everywhere, is climate change, because it is what will make this planet uninhabitable if we don't do something about it. But there is a big caveat to that, which is there are some threats which, if we don't sort out now, there might not be anything left worth saving. And so I point to overfishing, really, probably as the number one most pressing thing that, as an oceans campaigner, you know, keeps me awake at night and keeps me worried, because more than 3 billion people on the planet, so nearly half the planet, depend on the ocean for food. They are often the poorest people. They are often in the most vulnerable housing situations. They're living around the coast. They're subsistence fishers. You know, these are the parts of the world closest to the ocean have a high correlation with deprivation. And the ocean is their livelihood. And if we continue to extract fish at the rate we are, they're not going to have the nourishment, the livelihood that they deserve. So as a sort of most pressing one I find as an oceans campaigner, I always come back to fishing.
We're at the moment carrying out this interview in our own homes because we're in lockdown. And what we've seen over the last couple of months around the world is a reduction in our human footprint. Do you think that we'll learn any lessons from this period? Can you see any kind of positives that could come out of the situation that we're in now?
I don't know, is the honest answer. I think there is certainly a moment of disruption, of change that has heightened people's awareness of both the beautiful nature that they're suddenly taking the time to see or being able to hear through their window, the bird song, but they're also witnessing what governments can do when there really is a crisis. So people's eyes are certainly open to the possibility of major investment in infrastructure and very fast action by government. We don't associate governments in the West really with fast, decisive action, but now we can see, you know, it is possible, they can do it. And same goes for companies. When they want to, when they have to, they can. So there's certainly opportunity there, but I'd say it's far too early to tell. And the economic downturn, historically, when we've had recessions, it hasn't been that great for the environment. So I do think we've got a big fight on our hands, a major challenge to make sure we don't just rush back to a normal that's even more normal or even more accelerated in our extraction of resources and our burning of fossil fuels than it was before. And one of the things I've been doing in the last 7 weeks is tracking fishing fleets across the world. And we saw last week 95 boats fishing illegally in Argentina's exclusive economic zone. So 95 boats from East Asia's distant water fleet fishing illegally there. We're hearing stories off the north coast of French Guiana, another story in South Korea of workers being treated terribly. So actually, unfortunately, around the world at the moment, we're seeing a lot of people, a lot of companies taking advantage of a situation where there is a political attention is diverted elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, that's sad to hear, and I think that's happening in the world of plastics and big oil as well. Talking about plastics as well, you've written a book on how to give up plastic. Can you give some of our listeners just some simple steps that they can take to improve their own footprint and to give up plastic? If they were just to do two or three or four things, they couldn't do everything, what would be the best thing that they could do?
Well, I'll lump the big four into one, because I think that in the UK, people are generally already aware of these, which is, you know, get yourself a reusable coffee cup, get yourself a reusable water bottle, get yourself a reusable bag, and stop using straws. Do those four things, you have made a huge dent in your plastic footprint. In the UK, we use 35 million plastic bottles every single day. Only half of those end up getting recycled. So actions like those are having a big impact. But I'm aware that people listening to this podcast have probably already done all of those. So I think the next one, the one that I'd say probably had the biggest impact on my own plastic footprint, was just planning what you're going to have for lunch. And it sounds so simple, but in the UK last year, we used approximately 11 billion single-use plastic items for food on the go. Over the course of the year. So just by planning your making your sandwich, making your lunches on a Sunday to take into work for the rest of the week, or going and sitting down somewhere instead of grabbing it to go, that simple action could actually have a huge impact, particularly living in the city, where I know that we consume a lot more single-use plastic on the go, which is also often what gets littered and what ends up finding its way into waterways and eventually out into the ocean.
Well, hopefully lots of us have been spending a bit more time cooking at home, so learning how to cook various things. So hopefully we can take some of that advice with us. Who inspires you?
Lots of people. I mean, I'd say I am hugely inspired by the youth strikers, and that's all of them all across the world. Obviously, Greta's at the forefront, but I've had the privilege of meeting a lot of them over the last 18 months from Argentina, from Australia, from the UK, and that they are, you know, standing up for what they believe in and doing so in a way that grabs the hearts and minds of the politicians, media, public is incredible. And then, you know, other people, I just get to work with so many amazing scientists who want to use their work for the good of humanity, and that I just never fail to find that I shouldn't find it surprising, but I think it's so easy when you're doing a job to just focus on the thing that you're doing and narrowly sort of just say, this is my bit of research or this is my bit of work, and somebody else can go off and make use of it how they will. But actually, increasingly, because these scientists, these people everywhere, so whether that's Damien Chevalier, who we worked with in French Guiana, or it's Diva Ramon at the Natural History Museum, who works on the deep sea, or, you know, we've had the privilege of working with so many of these people who want to say, actually, the science is clear. The science is telling us right now we need to act. And this is no longer a case of, is the science there? It's a case of politicians being willing to listen. And when a scientist says that, it carries so much more gravitas. But it takes a lot of bravery. I think they are the people I tend to respect and admire.
Yes, well, I think the kind of days of we're all sick of experts are well and truly over. I think far more now, as we sit at home, hoping with hope that scientists find a way of beating the virus. We're all acutely aware of the great role that scientists play. What's been your biggest failure so far?
Well, we haven't got 30% of the world's oceans protected yet.
How much do we have?
Less than 4%. It's a bit debatable, the figure, but less than 4% fully protected for certain. Probably less than that, unfortunately.
And when did you say that? How long have we got to get
2030? We've got 10 years.
We've got 10 years.
We can do it.
Let's go to your proudest. What are you most proud of?
I am most proud of. Oh, well, we've just finished a year-long expedition from the Arctic to the Antarctic. And I have to say that is the thing I'm most proud of. It was we went down the Atlantic, started last April, finished in the March just gone, worked with more than 10 different scientific institutions, took more than 30 journalists on board with us, had crew from more than 35 countries join us at different points. And it was just the most phenomenal thing I've ever had the privilege to be a part of.
Wonderful. And final question, what piece of advice would you give your younger self?
I would say, if your gut's telling you don't do something, don't do it. So stand up for what you believe in. And I was quite good at doing that, I think, and certainly got in a lot of trouble sometimes for doing it. But ultimately, if you really believe in something, then it's worth fighting for.
Will McCallum, Head of Oceans for Greenpeace, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
Today's Behind the Story interview was brought to you by Nature 2030, a campaign run by Higginson Strategy. Higginson Strategy supports government bodies, NGOs, charities, companies and individuals, all within the business of making the world a better place. To hear more about our work or get involved with our positive campaigns, go to our website at higginsonstrategy.com.